I don't know how much you've watched it over the last few weeks, but the Commonwealth Games comes to an end today, and Usain Bolt has done his stuff, I understand, and Tom Daley has likewise done his stuff, and I gather he only got silver and was aiming at gold, but there we are. Today it ends, and though, to be honest, I've been on a beach mission the last week and haven't really followed much of it, I have heard snippets of the various medals achieved, as I've just illustrated. Things have happened. Records broken, people celebrated, pride for those that win things. I've got one or two friends in Scotland on Facebook, and their Facebook page has been, one of them's a pastor, and the Facebook page has been dominated by Scottish medals. I kind of want to say, haven't you got something else to do with your time? But there we are. I'm glad he's pleased. There we are, records broken and the Commonwealth Games. But behind it all are the athletes. And those athletes, the Commonwealth Games and I guess the Olympics are and the World Championships are they're the pinnacle of their achievements. But they don't just come out for the Commonwealth Games, do they? They're at it all the time. There is for them the constant reality that they are totally committed to the goal of winning prizes, of winning the prize, of trying to get to gold. And as they do that, they set aside all other influences on their lives and set their face to the goal, and everything else gives way. You'll have seen a moment ago, as Johnny read it, at the end of our passage this morning, the Apostle Paul describes his commitment to the gospel in the same way. But the context is that to do that, that priority of the gospel, he sets aside his rights, well, his rights to all sorts of things, as we're going to see. And we're going to look this morning, as we grasp together, the discipline of training for the glory of heaven. That's what this is really about, the discipline of training for the glory of heaven. You see, it goes completely against our culture, doesn't it, to set aside rights for anything. I have a right to is a phrase that trips off our lips and goes through our minds more easily than maybe lots of other things. I'm sure it's gone through your thoughts many times, even if you haven't said it. From definitions of poverty to demands for a certain standard of living to the freedom of movement to the freedom of expression. We've even got to a culture now where people have a right to life and, here's surprise in the news these last days, a right to die. People have a right to, and they want to assert those rights over and above anything else. The idea of having rights is ingrained into our culture. The right to go where we like or do what we like seem to be so much a part of our thinking that most of us put our rights automatically into almost any and every situation. We have a right to proper medical care, don't we? That's a given in this country, apparently. A right to good education. A right to a well-meant government, well-run government. So when Paul writes to the Corinthians, and in a mixed church setting which he founded with all the excitement of establishing a thriving gospel work in a place like Corinth, which was a busy port, and Paul was there for a year and a half, and huge influence. You'll read if you read from Acts 18, which we won't do this morning for sake of time. When he looks at somewhere like Corinth with all the possibilities and opportunities, and he writes to them in this first letter, and he says to them that he has foregone his rights to reach them, suddenly it must cause us to sit up and take notice. Because it, for them and for us, it's a real challenge to cultural norms. You see, just like our culture today, their culture had celebrities. With today, our cultural celebrities are sports people or journalists, I suppose, or musicians. For them, the cultural celebrities were a little bit different. They were philosophical orators, people who could come to a marketplace who would be sponsored by some rich someone or other, and they would hold a crowd as they had the warp and weft of the words that just caught the imagination and drew people in. A kind of Stephen Fry character, if you like, but people who always sought to toe the particular line of their patrons. And the more successful they were, the better orators they were, the more money they made. I suppose it's a bit like newspaper editors nowadays, always to push a particular point of view. And at the start of chapter 9, Paul takes the Corinthian Christians who are so muddled with their culture, have so many gifts and so much opportunity and so much potential, and he says to them, listen, you must stop absorbing your culture. You must stop acclimatizing yourself to what is norm in the culture and come back to who Jesus is. In my particular example, he says, I'm an apostle. I'm not a great orator, actually, but I do have something to say. I'm not following the line of whoever pays me the most, because that's not the point. I'm following the line of my master, and my master's line is the gospel. In fact, he puts it in stark terms in verse 19 at the beginning of our passage that he is free and belongs to no man. But the principle of who Paul answered to, picking up their idea of celebrity, was really just an illustration. The illustration that the same principle applies not just to gospel ministers, but to every Christian. For all who would engage in activity for Christ, that they must answer ultimately to their master, that if you're a Christian this morning, as I am, then we must answer ultimately to our master, the head of the church, the Lord Jesus, and apply our rights accordingly. So just scan your eyes with me across verses 19 to 27 as we progress through this, just for a few moments this morning. And let's see together what we have a right to. Paul says, verse 19, the first thing, he says, if you're a Christian, as I am, then you have a right to be a slave. Just pick up verse 19 with me and you'll see what I mean. Though I am free and belong to no man, he says, I make myself a slave to everyone for the reason to win as many as possible. What a shock it must have been to the Corinthians. A place where there were those at the bottom of society and those at the top of the society. Were we to read on into chapter 11, you'd find that even in the church services, even at the Lord's table, even at their church lunches, the poor people were shoved aside and the rich people got drunk on wine. How bizarre is that? A place so divided in society, Paul says, I use my right, my freedom, my serving of my master to be a slave. You see, he has the right to do as he likes. Both in chapter 6 and in chapter 10, he quotes the phrase that they keep on using. Just scan your eye across. Everything, he says, is permissible for me. Look at chapter 10, verse 23 across the page. Everything is permissible for me, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible for me, but not everything is constructive. Nobody, verse 24 of chapter 10, should seek his own good, but the good of others. Listen, says Paul, as he talks about being an athlete. Listen, he says, I take my right and I bury it under my responsibility. Here he is voluntarily laying aside his freedom so that he can win as many as possible. That is, so that he can evangelize, so that he can spread the good news about Jesus. How exactly does he do that? Well, the verses that follow explain. Verse 20, pick it up with me. So, for example, he says to the Jews, I become a Jew to win the Jews. Though I myself am not under law, I become like one under law. Though I myself am not under law, says to win those not under the law. To those, verse 21, not having the law, I become like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I become weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. Just think about that for a moment, what the Apostle Paul is saying. Think about all the different church disputes and discussions and theological debates that you and I know take place across the world all the time. If only you could get the Apostle Paul to come and sit down in your service and ask him the question. Imagine Paul somehow made an appearance here. We could have a question time with Paul. You know what would happen? Most of the other churches we know would close and they'd come on in here and they'd pummel Paul day after day with answers to questions. But you know what he says? I'm not interested in debating theology with you. I want to win souls, he says. To understand that, what that means in the first instance, we need to understand his first example, what it means to be a Jew. that is a descendant of Abraham. If you, we haven't time to go into all the detail right now, but if you skim read the New Testament, and particularly look at the book of Acts of the Apostles, it won't take you long to realize that the Jews, the Old Testament people of God, the descendants of Abraham, to whom the promise came, the Jews were very exclusive in the company that they kept. So when, for example, the Apostle Peter in Acts chapter 10 goes to the centurion Cornelius, who is not a Jew, he goes into his house and sits down and he says these words. He says, "You are well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with a Gentile, a non-Jew, or even to visit him. I'm breaking my own law by being here," he says. I'm taking an exception and taking my exclusivity and my specialness, and I'm laying it aside so that I can share the gospel with you, because in Acts chapter 10, Jesus has told me to. The Jews had ceremonies and festivals. They had circumcision. Paul spent a very great deal of his time teaching and writing that to be saved, you no longer have to conform to those Jewish practices anymore. So, for example, a Jew would never have eaten an animal that was regarded as unclean. But in his letter in Romans chapter 14, he goes again over the issue of eating food sacrificed to idols. And he says, as one who is in the Lord Jesus, I'm fully convinced that no food is unclean in itself. But Paul knew as he moved around the world that to be accepted by Jews with their ceremonies and their procedures and their attitudes and their actions, he's going to have to behave and conform as if he's a Jew. He knew, for example, that he just mustn't eat unclean food in their presence, non-kosher food, we would say, in their presence. He goes into further details specifically about the law. He says, "I'm not under law." That is, he doesn't believe that he has to keep the law of Moses to be saved, but he does so for them to hear the gospel. He does the same thing when it comes to circumcising Timothy so that he can freely work among the Jews in Acts 16, or observing Jewish purification rites in Acts 21. Paul says, you see, that when it comes to those who are narrow in their theology and narrow in their thinking, I'll close my freedom down because above anything else, I want them to know Jesus, and he'll liberate them. I wonder whether that's a challenge to you and me, how we feel about the idea of conforming what we have a right to do, taking our wide wings and folding them up so we don't fly. We might say that Paul had a right to do the right thing, but in order to get the gospel heard by them, Paul was willing to set aside his freedom, become a slave. In other words, for the sake of the Jews he was trying to reach so they could be saved, Paul makes clear that he was willing to forgo his own rights. That's the Jews, the narrow group. Then he says, look at the Gentiles. The Gentiles are everybody else, everybody that isn't a Jew. Which means the rest of the world. When he's with them, so that they might hear the gospel, he acts as if he's one of them. So if you go back to chapter 8, Paul was free, he said, to eat food sacrificed to idols without worrying it. Well, Gentile invites you to his house in Corinth, almost certainly the food that he's putting before you for dinner has been taken from the idol temple and given as some kind of worship in the first instance to some pagan god or other. Now, that might make you or I feel uncomfortable. But you know what? Paul says, I don't care. Jesus is Lord. Why should I care? I sit down with the food and I eat it. And as I eat it, I build relationship. And as I build relationship, so they get to ask me who I am and what I do and why I live. And I tell them about Jesus. And I don't care where the food comes from. But notice he says exactly the detail. Verse 21. To those not having the law, I become like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. That is to say, when Paul's in pagan territory, in his social behavior, he's accepted by them, but he did not act as someone with no obligation. That idea in its own right, opposite to the Jews, might come as a surprise to us. I said that he took his spread wings and folded them to reach the Jews. And you might want to say, well, the Gentiles, surely he simply opens them. Yes, but he knows. He knows. We like to quote the famous verse from Romans 6 that we're not under law but under grace. But we need always to remember that that doesn't mean we're not under law but under nothing. No, we're under grace. We do have an obligation. Being with Gentiles, Paul meant to be free to eat whatever that he wanted, to go wherever he liked, within the bounds of good or poor example, as discussed in chapter 8. But that did not mean he could do all the pagans do. So, for example, he might, to reach them, eat food sacrificed to idols, but he doesn't indulge with temple prostitutes. He might go to pagan homes, but he doesn't get drunk. He still had the obligations of grace. As Christ's slave, he was a free man, but not free to do what he liked, free to do what he should. He knew very well that as he trained for this race that we're going to come to in due course, he knew very well that true freedom is not the freedom to do what you like, but the freedom to do what you should. And if that sounds like Orwellian newspeak, just imagine, as I so often say, that if true freedom was the freedom to do what you like, we'd all just pick whichever side of the motorway we fancy to drive up, wouldn't we, with cataclysmic result. So he used the freedom first to conform himself so that he could win Jews, and second to spread himself so that he would win Gentiles. And likewise, he says, the weak, this third category he describes. The weak, they're weak not because they're not physically strong. The weak here are people who in Corinthian culture are just plain poor, socially weak, people who are never going to manage to get up the ladder. People whose jobs mean that, frankly, they're always going to be at the bottom of the pile. They're the street sweepers, they're the cleaners, they're the ancillary people. But Paul says, no, I don't care. I'll sit in the gutter with them if necessary, or become a tent maker with them, or whatever. I'm very happy to step down from my apparently exalted position to come alongside them to win them. And verse 22 is the crowning point. Look at it with me. When it comes to my rights, he says, I have a right to be a slave, either to conform to the Jews, to spread to the Gentiles, to go down to the weak. Why? Verse 22, because I have become all things to all men, so that by all means possible, I might save some. Can you see the driver in his thinking? I just want people to know Jesus, he says. I don't care where they come from. I want people to know Jesus. Because without knowing Jesus, everything else in their lives is pointless and fruitless and will one day end in wrath. He's not inconsistent. Rather, he's trying to set out to share the gospel with others so that they might become Christians and willing to set aside his rights to do so. Now, I'm challenged by that, and I hope you are too. I switch on the TV and I look at the Commonwealth Games and I see Usain Bolt running for gold, and I know I can't possibly ever run like that. I never could when I was young, and I'm certainly not going to be able to from here on. But I admire his commitment. And what am I committed to? Let me ask you what you're committed to. Does that sound like something what Paul describes that every Christian should be doing? Or do you think that that kind of attitude is restricted to the Christian special branch? We call that missionary. Do you think? Of course not. Of course it's not just for the special branch of missionary. That would be, therefore, Paul showing off, trying to be a super missionary. No, his point is that his rights have been set aside because of Jesus. And he's telling these Corinthians that their rights, which is the big discussion here, should likewise be set aside for Jesus. He's suggesting that the Corinthian Christians, indeed all Christians, should do the same. Let me illustrate it with something a little more up to date than the New Testament. There they, these days, seem to have moved away from the Bible. In the early 1700s, missionaries from the Moravian Church, founded by Count Zinzendorf in Germany, began a prayer meeting that was to last around the clock for 100 years. The church had a profound love for Christ, and their motto was simply this: our Lamb has conquered. Let us follow him. Taken from Revelation chapter 5. The first missionaries sent out left Copenhagen Harbour on October the 8th, 1732, on board a Dutch ship bound for the Danish, then the Danish West Indies. There were two missionaries on board, one John Leonard Dober, who was a potter, and the other David Nietzschmann, a carpenter. They were skilled speakers, but they knew that getting to the West Indies and being allowed to preach was going to be very difficult. So do you know what they did? They said that they were willing to sell themselves into slavery so that they could reach the slaves of the West Indies. And as the ship slipped away from harbor in Copenhagen, they lifted up a cry that would one day become the rallying call for all Moravian missionaries. May the lamb that was slain receive the reward of his suffering. You see what they've done? They set aside their rights for Jesus. Now, when I tell you that story, it seems to say, no, it is for the Christian special branch, just those who are missionaries, those of us that are teachers or doctors or dentists or shop workers or office workers or computer specialists or whatever it is. We don't come under this category. No, that's not right. You see, we're not all called to sail for the West Indies, to sell ourselves as bond slaves like those Moravians did. But as Jim Elliot, the martyr missionary to Ecuador, put it, we have bargained with him who bore a cross. We have rights. How are you using yours? How am I using mine? We have the rights to be slaves of Jesus wherever we work, wherever we live, the rights to put Jesus first. And before you think that either Paul or maybe I are ranting unreasonably, just see what motivates Paul. He had the right to be a slave, he says, and the right to share blessing. Verse 23 of our passage. I do all this, he says, for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. What are the blessings of the gospel? Well, we'll see. There's no doubt of Paul here being saved. That's not the point he's making. Paul was a Christian who, like those Moravians, but more so, always had his eye on the judgment to come. And that's the point. Always had his eye on eternity to come. Always had his eye on the glory of heaven to come. And he wanted everyone he met to share the blessings of heaven with him. I think it's to several of the New Testament churches, the Colossians come to mind. He says to them that one day he's looking forward to being in glory and to bowing before the Lord of glory and effectively saying, as the Colossians or the Ephesians or the Thessalonians come before the throne of grace, he's looking forward to saying to Jesus, look, Lord, what I've brought you. These people who were far from grace, I've had the privilege of sharing the gospel with them, and look, together we stand before the throne of heaven, and together we're praising you for all that you're worth. Paul wants to share in the blessing of glory of men and women and boys and girls from all over the world, of every culture and tribe and nation, standing before the throne and saying, Jesus is Lord. Can you see? He wants everyone he met to share the blessings of heaven with him. It drives his thinking and his attitude and his actions and his priorities and his spending. The gospel was what drove him. As a later Christian missionary, the famous cricketer C.T. Studd could say, if Christ be God and died for me, then no sacrifice is too great for me to make for him. Now think about that for a moment. Paul was motivated by heaven. Isn't that challenging? Are you challenged by that? What's your view of heaven? If I were to ask you right now to get the notice sheet and pull out your pen and scribble down, heaven for me is, what would you say? What would you write? Do you know, I think for most of us, we'd probably have to say, heaven for me is the only compensation available for dying. That's not it. It's not compensation for dying. Actually, if it's that, then you and I, we need to rethink the gospel. Heaven is home in the gospel. The kingdom of God is freely open to all. Christ had died to take the penalty for your and my rebellion and has commanded everyone everywhere to re- to turn from their self-centered lives and turn to God and be rescued, to be saved, to spend eternity with him in glory. If you're already a Christian, don't you feel desperate to take others with you to that glory? Don't you long for other people to stand around the throne of grace and say, look, look who this is. Look at the lamb that was slain, the lion of the tribe. Aren't you desperate for men and women and boys and girls to be in glory with you one day? Or do you care so little for the people around you and actually for the honor of the Lord Jesus that you can't be bothered to put yourself out? And if you find that compelling, as I do, then what should we do about it? We have the right to be slaves. We have the right to share blessing. But look at this last section, the Commonwealth Games bit. Paul says we have the right to self-control. See, to answer that question, Paul takes an example from the original Olympic Games, or perhaps something similar, which happened near Corinth. Either way, we know what he's talking about with the Commonwealth Games all over the TV. Do you know, he says, verse 24, that in a race, all the runners, I guess even if they are running with Usain Bolt, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize. Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last. Hey, but we, you and me, Corinthian Christians, you and me, Chippenham Christians, we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Now, don't misunderstand here. There's no sense of only one prize. That's not the point he's making. All illustrations have their limits, and we've just found this one. That would deny what's been said about sharing the blessings of heaven, which he's just said. No. No, the point is what to do about it. Run as if to get the prize. He's saying that in the training, in the preparation, in the longing, in the glory, you set your eyes on heaven and you say, Jesus died to take me there. That's where I'm going. Let's go for it together. Self-control. See, in Paul's day as in ours, athletes train to be the best. Usain Bolt trains to be the best. Tom Daley trains to be the best. Even those that are up against those guys train to be the best. And the training regime is strict. Hours of training each day, restricted activity, careful diet. And for what? Do you know what they did it for in the Commonwealth Games? So that for those few moments as they stand on the podium, someone can take a ribbon and put Commonwealth Games and put it over their neck and everyone can say, well done. But you know what? I've read of so many athletes who get the gold, not just at the Commonwealth Games, cool as they are, but at the Olympics and beyond. And as they step down from the podium and walk to the changing room, so many athletes say, what do you mean, that's it? All of it for this? In Paul's day, they didn't get a medal. They got a crown made of laurel. Well, I've got loads of laurel growing behind my garden. It's a pain in the neck. Anyone wants to come and get some laurel, please just bring some shears. In fact, I'll lend you the scissors. Help yourself. Or apparently celery. I'll let you work that out. Our goal, on the other hand, is not a laurel crown or even a medal. Our goal, says Paul, is a crown that will last. The crown of glory awaiting us in heaven, where the Lord himself will speak to us and say, well done, my good and faithful servant. So aim to win, says Paul. Aim high. Go for gold with your walk and your witness and your attitude and your action and your self-control. Don't be bamboozled by a world that sets standards that you can't achieve with your body or your intellect. Be captivated by the gospel so you can do everything in your power to share it with others and take them with you. Aim to win, says Paul. You know, it's easy to be motivated when challenged to go for it. Other by a Bible passage or a missionary example. When Jerry shares with us in a few minutes after lunch some of the stories from Hundredfold, I have no doubt most of us will sit there and go, wow, that's really cool. Maybe I could. But actually, the emotional high of that challenge doesn't last. And it starts tomorrow morning. It starts tomorrow morning when we've got to get up early for time with the Lord before going off to work. That's where it starts. Or it starts as we live our lives daily in a world that is constantly trying to seduce us by the advertising of our culture, which asserts our rights and not our responsibilities. Or when that regular sinful habit captures us again and won't let us go, and somehow the priority of the cross and the lure of heaven, well, they'll be put on hold for another day. Or when our tempers are short because we're tired, or, well, it all seems a bit remote, doesn't it? But Paul, you see, found the same problem. This is a real man in real world, and he's talking to real Christians who are having the same mixed up emotional conflict that we have all the time. And what does he say to them? Verse 26, he says, I'm not just a runner. No, he says, I'm a boxer too. Therefore, I don't run like a man running aimlessly. I don't fight like a man beating the air. I've seen on films, as you have, those guys that stand and they do that. And it looks very impressive, but there's no muscle being built as you do that. No, he says, verse 27, I beat my body. I make it my slave so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. So seriously does Paul say he took his task of self-control, of winning others for Christ, of foregoing his rights and even his desire so that they might hear of Christ. So serious is Paul about these things that he forced himself. He's not talking here about what the Catholic monks used to do, where they beat themselves to be more pure. That's not biblical Christianity. That's just crazy. No, he's talking about being self-controlled, that he wouldn't let anyone get the better of his honor by him of his Lord. What irony it would be, he says, if he preached to others and in the end turned out himself not to be saved. Is that possible? Is what motivates him the idea that he can somehow clamber up to heaven? No, no, that's not his point. His point is not that I'm a missionary and I'm preaching and somehow I'm trying to make sure I don't lose my salvation. That's not his point. His point is that I'm demonstrating that Jesus is Lord with every fiber of my being, because that's what I want to do. That's what the assurance is. If you drift on into chapter 10, you'll see that he takes the warning from Israel's history. Scripture is clear that once you're saved, you're always saved, but the point is that many of those in Moses' day who left slavery in Egypt simply did not take the gospel seriously and believe and trust in Jesus, and so did not make it to the promised land. Listen, he says, you have the right to be a slave. You have the right to share blessing. You have the right to self-control. In the end, Paul saw his rights only in the light of the privilege of his responsibilities, which was to know Christ and make him known. And he's longing for these Corinthian Christians, mixed up as they are, to do the same.